Good morning. Everyone has sheets? Everyone hopefully has? Okay, great. I'm going to note here, as some of you have seen, my Beit Midrash is very happy to be able to offer the classes that we offer, but we are funded entirely by local donations, and so we're having our annual dinner in June. For those who are not able, please continue to come to classes. For those who are able, your help is appreciated. Thanks very much. We are in week three. Yeah, it's not my favorite part of this. Yeah, I didn't work for public radio. We are in week three, but we're still finishing up week two of the topic of Jewish love. In week one, we talked about love and its and the union that is a marriage in Judaism, going all the way back to the story of Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve. And we talked about the way that the biblical text presents two accounts of the way they meet. The first account focused on procreation, and the second account focused more on Ezer Kenegdo, a helpmate opposite, somebody who will help them to grow ethically and spiritually. We talked about the idea of pure love as well as a separate concept. And then we moved into a discussion of marriage. And we began by noting what Maimonides wrote, that what Judaism changes in terms of marriage is, number one, the element of having witnesses, where it isn't just people decide we're going to live together and that's that, but that there's a communal component. There are witnesses. There's an element of a transaction as well. It isn't simply we decided and that's it, but there's what's called in Hebrew a kinyan, something that symbolizes commitment. And the element of what I will call permanence, although it's not, maybe durability is a better word. I mean, this week we are going to get to a discussion of divorce, so clearly permanence is not part of the model. But durability, at any rate, it is supposed to be part of it. And the idea is that marriage is supposed to be more formal and more durable than what it was in its unlegislated sense before Sinai. And the goal of it is to create an environment that's going to enable the parties to meet their needs in terms of the first part, procreation, and the second part, in terms of their spiritual growth. So what we're doing now, we started on it briefly last week, is to talk about the first piece of it, which is how it is that Judaism attempts to make marriage an environment for procreation. Now, clearly not everybody is able to have children, and not everybody even wants to. But what we're talking about is a generalization, which is the overall structure based on that original version of Pru Urvu, to bear fruit and to multiply, is geared towards making that a possibility. So there is a biblical mitzvah of onah, which we talked about. Onah literally means a set time, and the mitzvah is that the husband, as we saw last week, I brought again source number one here, the husband is instructed to provide three basic needs for his wife. The third of them is onah, and it is the mitzvah of sexual relations, that he has to be with her, and it's on a periodic basis. The periodic basis is defined based on what his career is. So in other words, if he has a career that takes him far away from home, he's a sailor, then the understanding is that onah will be less frequent. In the event that he's in town, then the onah will be more frequent, but it's his obligation to her. Yes, she is able to say, I'm not interested. It's not as though she is compelled, but that's his obligation to her. There is an obligation on both sides, and that's what I wanted to pick up with this time. If you take a look at Maimonides in source number two, he speaks of the obligation from him to her and from her to him. And again, this is all part of creating an environment in which they will procreate. So a man may not withhold onah from his wife. If he does this to pain her, he violates a biblical prohibition. And that's the verse that I've given you in number one. So he's not allowed to say to her, I am not interested in this. If he is ill or weak, such that he can't manage this, so he's allowed to wait 6 months to recuperate. I don't know why 6 months. I don't know what doctor weighed in on 6 months as the appropriate period of time for recuperation, but so he writes. No, actually, I do know. It's the rest of the clause. For there is no acceptable onah period longer than this. Meaning that when they get married, he has to commit that this is what he's going to do. I don't care what his job is for a living. I don't care what takes him out of the home. This is the minimum requirement for him. After that, he should either request her permission, meaning she can say, I don't care, or he's going to have to divorce her and pay her the ketubah payment. So in other words, he is held responsible for the fact that he is not fulfilling this for her. And again, this goes back to what we said in week one, when we said that this is a basic part of the relationship. Now, I should stress something, because I'm framing this in a very utilitarian way. I've presented this idea of onah as part of making sure the marriage will fulfill that first of the two imperatives that we saw, the imperative to procreate. However, it's not only about procreation. And the proof of it is that this mitzvah of onah, his obligation to her, does not end at the time when they're no longer producing children. His obligation of onah is a lifelong obligation to her, so that it's not only about bearing children; it's also part of what that brings into the relationship altogether. I wanted to make sure to note that, but that's his duty to her. Sorry.
She can divorce him.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about that in the second part of today's class. That's when we'll have the divorce conversation. But the answer is that, as you just saw in Maimonides, in the event that he withholds onah from her, that's grounds for divorce. That is correct.
Only onah or food and clothing?
Food and clothing as well. We just happen to be on onah right now because we're talking about the issue of procreation. But yes, food and clothing absolutely are part of this. And not only those, but other obligations, which we'll get to as well. So that's his obligation to her. But don't kid yourself, there's a second half to this. If a woman withholds... Sorry?
Yeah. I don't know whether this is the right thing to ask. Can't you mention that they can choose not... You didn't say they don't. They may not want children. Is that an option?
So that's a really good question. I said that they don't necessarily want to have children for whatever the reason is. So the answer is that there is a biblical mitzvah, which we go back to of procreation. It is actually technically an obligation for him and not for her, which is interesting given who does all the heavy lifting. I once saw a very interesting explanation for this. I think it was Rabbi David Shapiro, who was the head of school of Maimonides School in Boston. I think he was the source of this. The idea that the reason why the obligation is his and not hers is because so much is demanded of her for it that it wouldn't be right for it to be a mitzvah. This has to be her decision and not God saying you have to have children. But in terms of the basic mitzvah, he does have an obligation to have children. There may be reasons why he can't fulfill it. There may be a whole host of reasons why he can't fulfill it. Anything ranging from being not psychologically prepared to do so, or you have a husband and wife who have genetic concerns for the baby. There can be all sorts of reasons why one wouldn't fulfill it, just like any other mitzvah. We do view it as a very important one because it's the very first thing God says he wants in the Torah. Nonetheless, at the end of the day, there could be factors that override. Where things get thornier, and what we're not going to have time for in this series, is the question of, so what are the mechanics of this? What does that mean? What are acceptable methods of contraception? So while that's a fun discussion, it's not going to be for right now. But the answer is there are ways. That would be what I would say right now. The second half of this source, of number two, speaks to her obligation to him. If a woman withholds relations from her husband, she is termed a rebel. The term in Hebrew is a moredet. We ask why she has rebelled. If she says, I am repulsed by him, and I cannot willingly do this with him, so we force him to divorce her. She is not a captive to be with a man she hates. She's not paid the ketubah. And what we're talking about here in terms of the ketubah, just in case anyone doesn't remember from last week, it's an important thing to know about. You're familiar with the ketubah as the document that the witnesses sign at a wedding. But what the ketubah really is, and we'll see more about this shortly, is the formalization of a man's obligations to his wife when they get married. There are no obligations upon her that are memorialized in the ketubah. It's his duty to her, but the most basic one is the obligation for him to pay her a sum of money in the event of either his death or in the event of divorce. And the goal of this sum of money is actually not so much support as it is to make him think carefully before divorcing. Because, as we're going to have to discuss, the control of divorce is put in his hands, in the sense that he is the one who initiates. There is a fear that he's going to do this precipitously. And so the way that this is prevented is by saying, okay, you can divorce her, but you're going to have to cough up a significant sum of money. You'll say, well, how much is it? So by default, although the sum can be changed, only up, not down, but by default, it's 200 zuz. So you'll say, well, what's 200 zuz? You actually know what 200 zuz is, because you sing a song once or twice a year involving two zuz, right? So what is two zuz? The price of a goat. So 200 zuz is 100 goats. Not a bad deal. You lose the husband and you gain 100 goats. There's a lot to be said about this. It's time to bring him back. But that's the idea. The amount is usually inflated over that. If you've ever been at a wedding where they read the ketubah out loud, during the chuppah, they read the ketubah out loud. So so Ashkenazim, it's boring because we never change the ketubah; it's always the same. However, in Sephardic communities, they will actually increase the amount for the ketubah, and they sing the ketubah out during the chuppah, and you hear like how much they've added to it. It's always in dollars, which is great. But the idea of the ketubah then is that it's meant to be, for him, a means of stop and think, don't do this precipitously. However, in the event that the woman says, I have no interest in being with him, it's not fair to him to then say, and by the way, you have to pay the ketubah. And you're putting a disincentive for divorce in his way when she wants out. So therefore, in this case, they get divorced, but we're not going to have him pay her the ketubah. Interestingly, there's a lot of debate rabbinically about whether the ketubah is biblical as an obligation or rabbinic as an obligation. The overall tendency is to view it as both, in the sense that the biblical text uses a word mohar, which interestingly, Muslims have as well. They say mohr, M-O-H-R, with something going on between the H and the R, but essentially it's the same word. And it was a payment which originally was done at the time of marriage. Both Muslims and Jews moved it to the end of the marriage, to the time of divorce or his death. And I think the rationale being the same in both cultures, but that's what became the ketubah. So you have it as a biblical idea at the time of the marriage, called a mohar. That's the sum of money that he gives her. She may bring in a dowry, but he has to give her this, which becomes rabbinically the ketubah at the end of the marriage. Okay. So what we've seen here so far, we're still not done with source number two, is that he has an obligation of onah to her. She has a duty to him as well. In the event that she says, I am not interested because he disgusts me, so we force him to divorce her. And if she rebels, we're still in this source number two, if she rebels to cause him pain, saying, I am doing this to hurt him because he did X, or he cursed me, he fought with me and the like, so I'm going to show him. The court sends her a message. Know that if you maintain this, you will even lose the 100 maneh, 200 zuz, of your ketubah, that she could actually lose the ketubah for this. Okay. So it's the same ending. It's just the difference is what is her motivation. Thank you. A male here. I appreciate it.
But it said we force him to divorce her.
Correct.
That's right. So
we're going to talk about that. Oh yeah. No, that's not. We're not pretending that's not there. Yes.
But isn't a ketubah strictly in a get considered a legal contract?
Yes and no. Welcome back.
Good answer.
The answer is yes. It is a legal contract within Judaism. No, a secular court will never enforce it for a couple of reasons. Number one, secular courts will not recognize something that uses currencies that you can't clearly translate into dollars. Saying 100 goats worth just isn't going to cut it. So that's number one. Number two, because in general, marriage contracts within secular law require that that each side divulge their finances beforehand, which is not required for the ketubah, although we're going to talk about that a little bit later in terms of marital finances. And then the third reason is because at many weddings, I'm not going to take a poll here, but at many weddings, the parties involved actually don't know what the ketubah says. Meaning, at weddings that I've officiated at, and many weddings that I've seen, the rabbi will sit down and explain to the chatan, to the groom, because he's the one taking on the obligations, you should know this document says that you're going to treat her well, that you're going to pay her this, and so on, but there's no word-for-word translation of it. The secular court's going to look at it and say they didn't know what they were doing. So for all of those reasons, the secular court, generally speaking, will not honor the ketubah, but that's the... But it is binding in our system. So we have a system which is meant to enable procreation and has this onah, this duty that he has to her, the duty that she has to him. But in addition to that, it also tries to set up a relationship in which they will focus on each other. There's a remarkable practice called Shana Rishona. You ever hear of this?
Yeah.
What does it mean? What is Shana Rishona?
That men can go to the army and they have to be treated well by everyone in the family and invited and until they have the house set.
So what Sarah's talking about, Shana Rishona literally is first year. That's what it is.
It's like a honeymoon.
Right.
One-year honeymoon.
Yes. It's a biblically based practice that has other elements that have been added in which they are meant to focus on each other for a year. Take a look at source number 3, which is indeed the army verse that is the basis for this. It says that when they get married, he shall not go to the army and it shall not place any obligations upon him for any matter. He shall be free for his household for 1 year, and he shall gladden the woman he has married. And again, all the jokes about whether she's happy or he's around or not, that's a side, you know, you can, you know, fill in your own joke there. But based on this, the Sefer HaChinuch, which is a classic 13th century work that tries to collect all of the Torah's mitzvot and explain each of them in turn, sees two commandments here. Number one, the groom shall not be taken from his home. And number two, that the groom has an obligation to gladden his bride during this first year, with the goal being that if they spend a lot of time with each other, that becomes normal for them. When a man and a woman first get married, they're used to their circle of friends, they're used to their business, they're used to their family. They need to create a new world in which their focus is each other, and those who are not of this couple lose some of that familiarity, are seen as being somehow more distant than the couple to each other. The others should be seen as a little bit foreign. And this way, they form the closest relationship that they're going to have with each other. That's the practice of Shana Rishona, first year. So in observant circles, this is taken very seriously. So, for example, normally someone who is a student in yeshiva is expected to participate in yeshiva morning, afternoon, and night. However, in the first year after marriage, he's not allowed to go to the yeshiva at night. He's required to stay home. This is something that's taken very seriously, and I think, quite frankly, in the right circumstances, assuming that the couple is right for each other to begin with, this can be a very strong boost for their marriage. Beyond the first year, there are other rules. And this takes us back to the first source we talked about in discussing marriage, which was the Mike Pence business, right? Where we talked about the world reaction to the discovery that he would not eat a meal alone with a woman other than his wife, and that he would not drink alcohol at an event with women present unless his wife was there as well. And we saw some who were very positive and others who were horrified. So take a look at source number 4. Because this is a basic rule within Judaism. It is the rule of Yichud. Maimonides writes in source number 4, one may not be alone with any of the forbidden erva relationships. The erva relationships are the ones identified in the Torah, in the book of Leviticus, as prohibited. So, somebody who's married to somebody else, incestuous relationships, whether they are young or old, it doesn't matter what their age is, can't be alone with them. Needless to say, or maybe not needless to say, two things actually should be said. Number one is this doesn't mean that there is grounds to speak badly about people. You know, if you happen to hear a rumor, I'm going to communicate a rumor about somebody because I saw him with her. The fact that we're telling them they shouldn't be together doesn't now license us to start telling rumors about people who didn't follow this. The rumor mill is a bad thing. But second, there are pragmatically certain leniencies that are employed because you can't physically get around in the world in this way. So, you know, for example, you have a psychologist. Let's say there's a female psychologist and a male patient. So are you going to tell me that the male patient can't go to the female psychologist because they're going to be alone? Whether it's a good idea or not a good idea is something to discuss, but one of the ways that is dealt with for this is to have the receptionist in the outer room, and I know one psychologist, a male, who keeps the door a little bit open, but a white noise machine going. So that the receptionist is able to look in and see what's going on without necessarily hearing that which is being discussed in the session. We talked about last time the OBGYN and the rules that exist secularly for this. In another community in which I lived, there was a rabbi within the community, not observant, thank God, Orthodox, whatever, fine, but he managed to get himself in trouble with a woman in the community, and I was at the clergy meeting afterwards where they were discussing, you know, the lessons to be learned from this, and somebody said, you know, from now on, I'm not going to meet alone with a congregant. Good. You learned the lesson. Whether it means that you have a big glass window so that people can see in, or whether you're meeting in a public place, or however you're going to handle it, this is common sense. And certainly in today's world, it's common sense. So there's a requirement that they not put themselves in a position to do something inappropriate. And then, in addition to that, that one you may have known about, but look at number five. A woman can prevent her husband from embarking on business unless it is nearby, lest he keep her from Onah. He may only leave with her permission. So again, part of this is that she can say, I don't want you going on a distant trip. And then number six, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, you have two parts. One is written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, that's the Sephardic part, and then Rabbi Moshe Isserles has Ashkenazi commentary. So Rabbi Karo writes, where a husband wishes to give his wife her appropriate food and have her eat on her own, he may, so long as he eats with her on Friday night. At least Shabbos you have to eat with her. Rabbi Isserles says no. Some disagree, contending that he may not tell her to eat alone unless she agrees of her own will. And so appears correct to me. You have to share meals together as well. The idea, this one isn't as well known. But the idea of being home for dinner, I think, is a nice idea. But this is all part of what we talked about initially, which is creating a home which will be sound and which will be durable. This is focusing on their relationship with each other in terms of procreation, but now I want to shift gears. I'm going a little bit quicker than I'd like. I'd rather have more conversation, but we still have to get to the divorce topic, or at least some of it today. Making sure that the marriage will be sound in terms of their personal growth, their ethical growth. So what it begins with is financial security, and specifically her financial security. Because historically, the male was in a much better financial situation. He would have been the one who would own land. He would have been the one, as a general rule, not exclusively, but he would have been the one who was more out there in terms of business, and she would be relying on him for her financial security. So take a look at source number seven. This tells us the list of obligations that the man accepts upon himself historically when he would get married. When a man weds a woman, he accepts 10 obligations and receives 4 items. The 10 are, so 3 are biblical, we talked about those, food, clothing, and onah. 7 are rabbinic, and they are healing her should she become ill, medical bills, redeeming her should she be taken captive, a reality, unfortunately, for much of Jewish history, burying her should she die, having her fed from his estate, and living in his home after his death while she is a widow. So if he dies, First, she stays in the house. She is supported from his estate. Having her daughters fed from his estate after his death until their marriage, so her daughters are taken care of as well. Having her sons from him inherit her ketubah over and above their inheritance with their brothers. So if he has children from multiple marriages, her kids are entitled to the ketubah before any discussion of splitting the rest of the property. So these are meant to provide her with a degree of financial security separate from the ketubah payment. There are also her obligations to him. There is the element of her responsibility that's in the rest of this source. The four that he acquires are rabbinic, to receive her earned income. So if she makes money during the marriage, he is supporting her. He gets the income. Before the question is asked, she is able to say, I don't want you to support me, and I want to keep my income. So in the event that that she has a higher income than he does, she's entitled to say, I'll just keep my income, thank you very much. And that works. To receive objects that she finds, same idea. To benefit from her property during her lifetime, so whatever she brings into the marriage is by default shared, and yes, there are ways that she can keep stuff herself. And to inherit from her, should she predecease him, he would precede all others for inheritance. Those are the terms for what he receives. But it's not just about financial security. It's also about financial honesty. There's a document that is signed at a traditional wedding. I'm curious, though, how many know it by its name. It's called the Tanaim.
Yes.
Yeah. People familiar with the Tanaim. Yeah. Why is everyone familiar with the Tanaim, or some people?
Well, that's a financial arrangement.
It's sort of an arrangement, but what happens with the Tanaim when the Tanaim are signed?
They're married.
No, they're not.
They're betrothed.
No, not even that. No, it's nothing like that. It's actually a waiver. It's not a waiver. But that's not why people know them. People know them because after that's when you break the plate.
Yes, I know.
That's why people know about Tanaim. You can't miss the plate breaking. The Tanaim, literally Tanaim means conditions. And what it is a document that's actually supposed to be from both families. It's not even about the people who are getting married. It's from their two families stating that there are no outstanding financial obligations from one to the other. Anything that he was supposed to pay for, anything that she was supposed to pay for, is all taken care of, free and clear, and therefore there are no obstacles to getting married. Today, it's a relatively meaningless document, because they're all there expecting to get married right afterwards. But historically, you would do this a year, as much as a year before the wedding. This was the engagement party, if you will. They was when they would actually sign this document to say, okay, we're all ready, and then they would move ahead with all the preparations for the marriage. So you'll ask, then why do we do it nowadays at all? What's the answer? No.
Tradition,
maybe, sorry.
Don't they need a guest after that?
Not after tonight, no.
Well,
no.
On both sides.
It's a photo op. It's a photo op. You can have two people who are going to sign as witnesses. You get a picture of everybody smiling together. The videographer can take video. You can honor somebody by having him read out the language of the Tanaim, which, since it's in Hebrew, most people aren't aware that what they're hearing is a waiver. And it starts with Mazel Tov, and it's very nice.
Why do they bring the
waiver saying that we have no claims upon the, any financial claims that were there before are gone? So good question. So Sarah asks, so then why are they breaking the plate? What's with the plate breaking? So there are, of course, a multiplicity of explanations, but one explanation, which I particularly like, is that the plate that is broken is supposed to be pottery, specifically, and the idea is that when you break pottery, you can't put it back together. You can't fix it. And the point is, if you break your word, then the word cannot be repaired. That's the image of breaking the plate, because you're giving your word that you're going to do everything you said you were going to do. So therefore, you break the plate. But that's the image.
Ashkenazim
do it. I don't know. I believe Sephardim do, but I don't actually know that. I never watched to see.
It's very
Yeah. Okay. The take a look at source number 8, and you'll see why I mentioned it's na'im. Not just to talk about the plate, but see number 8, because this is from the text of the Tanaim. And they shall neither, they is the husband and wife, shall neither shift away nor conceal, neither him from her nor her from him, any assets in the world. Rather, they shall control their assets equally in peace and tranquility in the manner of people of Torah and those who revere God. Stop laughing, Diane. The message presented is of a household in which there is financial transparency and financial equality. That's the way it was supposed to be done. There was debate historically about whether this was simply expressing a nice idea, like this is what we believe in, it's a good thing to do, or whether this had legal teeth to it. There's a response of Rabbi Yosef Kolon, also known as the Ma'arik, in the 15th century, in which he actually held that it was a practical duty of the husband to divulge all things and to share all assets with his wife and make the decisions together. The man had accused his wife of impropriety, and he had seized possession of all the property she had brought into the marriage and all of her assets. And Rabbi Kolon says, no, you've got to give it all back because that's not him, say so. So going back to the 15th century, right, 600 years ago, you had enforcement of this agreement. It wasn't just a nice idea and pretty language. It was actually meant to be legally binding. And that debate continues today. There's a very interesting exchange of articles going back about 15 to 20 years ago between two rabbis in Israel who are major authorities in Jewish law, Rabbi Avram Sherman and Rabbi Shlomo Dykovsky, debating as to whether this should be viewed as the basis for new legislation in Israel regarding financial egalitarianism within marriage, to say, look, this was always a Jewish value and therefore it should be carried forth in the laws in society today. But that's the message.
Yeah. So where did the tradition of the knipple, it's an Ashkenazi tradition for women to have a little money set aside that they keep, but isn't necessarily shared?
So I have to admit not being familiar with the term. I've learned a new one. Well, I know it's Yiddish, but it's not a practice I'm familiar with, so I can't really say. I will follow up afterwards by email. So if you're on the email list, then you will get the response once I have a chance to look into it. I will tell you this. Going back to Talmudic times, going back to Talmudic times, there was discussion about mechanisms the wife could employ to shield her property from her husband, ranging from simply stipulating with him that when they get married, this isn't coming into the marriage, or stipulating if she gets something during the marriage, this is not going to be joint property, to what was called mavriach. To be boreach in Hebrew is to run away. Mavriach is to cause, to flee. Ways in which she could structure her finances, essentially what we would call today a prenup. The ways she could structure her finances such that the husband would not have access to things that she had. And as long as it was above board, not something that anyone was lying about, where he thought something was happening and then it turns out it's not, it worked. Now, let's not kid ourselves, because the things that I'm talking about now in terms of the finances make Judaism sound like, very wonderfully biased in favor of the bride. While it's nice to come across that way, that's not entirely true. There's a balance. So take a look, please, at source number 9, and you find out what's expected from her. Still Maimonides, for consistency's sake, I'm just bringing Maimonides as the source of law all along, where relevant. To show you it's all from the same book. What should she do for him? Whatever the local custom is, to weave where they weave, to embroider where they embroider, to spin wool or linen where they do. And she washes his face, hands, and feet, prepares his drink, arranges his bed, performs other services like giving him water or a cup or taking them from before him. This is part of what she's accepting that she's going to do as part of the marriage, personal care and running of the household. unless they're wealthy enough to hire help, in which case she can do that for all but intimate matters. In addition, we mentioned the financial benefits that were listed at the end of source number 7, the earned income and so on. But you recognize that both, you know, there is a concern for what each of them are getting out of this. It's handled with legislation, and the goal ultimately is to create a marriage in which neither of them has fears for their security. But it goes beyond financial security. It includes physical security. Take a look, please, at source number 10. Historically, in every culture, Jewish, non-Jewish, Europe, Asia, North America, doesn't make a difference what you're talking about, there has been concern for domestic abuse. And because males, as a stereotype, but as a fair generalization, the males tend to be stronger, the concern was more about males abusing their wives. So take a look at source number 10, which I bring as a sample of rabbinic approaches to it. Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg was a leading, if not the leading, authority in Jewish law in Ashkenaz in Germany in this period. He says, every member of the covenant must honor his wife. This is, he's dealing with an allegation of domestic abuse from a husband to a wife. So he says, every member of the covenant, which means every Jew, member of the covenant, ben brit, must honor his wife more than his own person. She is elevated with his status and not lowered with him. He's borrowing language from the Talmud. The idea of elevated with his status and not lowered with him is the Talmud's phrase regarding standard of living. Meaning that if he comes from a certain level of wealth and she comes from a lower level of wealth, he's not entitled to say, well, I don't need to spend that much on you because, after all, you're not used to my standard of living anyway. She goes up with his standard of living and does not go down. So in the event that he marries up, so to speak, her standard of living is greater than his, the Talmud says he's obligated to meet her standard of living. She can forgive it, but that's her choice. So that's where he's borrowing this phrase from. She is elevated with his status, not lowered with him. And we learn from the text of the Ketubah. The text of the Ketubah says, and I will work and honor and feed her. And regarding one who strikes his wife, my tradition is to be more strict than with someone who hits another person. For one is not obligated to honor another person, but one is obligated to honor one's wife. Striking them is the way of the nations, he says. There's a stereotype for you. He says, God forbid for any member of the covenant to do this. One who does this should be banned and excommunicated and whipped and punished with all manner of force and even to cut off his hand if he does this regularly. As Rav Huna did, he brings you a passage from the Talmud. Even in Babylon, where we do not issue fines, the courts did not have the same powers as they did in Israel, we may strike and punish to keep them from failing to take this seriously, and if she wishes to leave, he must divorce her and pay her ketubah. No tolerance for it, and the fact of physical security is taken as a given.
When he says the nations, in fact, the expression rule of thumb,
yes,
is the fact that it comes from the idea that you cannot beat your wife with anything thicker than your thumb.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the rule of thumb.
That was the rule of thumb.
Huh. You learn something new every day.
You learn it all.
Rule of thumb. Okay. I was not aware of that. Okay. I will say this. It is important to recognize that Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg is writing in Ashkenaz, in Europe. And the reason I say that is because you do find different standards in different cultures. And in Sephardic lands, where Jews lived among the Muslims, you will find what may fairly be called some influence of their policies in terms of the husband's treatment of a wife make it into some of the Jewish texts as well. You can't pretend that it's not there. You still find an adherence to the basic standard of honoring her and so forth, but some things do end up creeping into some of the texts in those lands in that period of time. Sylvia.
I have a question about the text of the Ketubah, and I will work and honor and feed her. So why is it that it seems to me that it's so important that a woman works and her husband
Right. So this is actually a very good question. The text of the Ketubah indeed says, if you've heard it read aloud, the words Va'ana Eplach Va'okir Ve'ezon Va'afarnes. Eplach, Hey Lamed Chet, is an Aramaic term. The Ketubah is generally Aramaic. It's an Aramaic term for work. Okir is to honor, like the word yakar in Hebrew. Ezon, mazon, to feed. Afarnes is like parnasa, to support. So the obligations are all there within the Ketubah. Sorry? Falachim? Not familiar with the word. Okay, well then yes. I mean, you know that Arabic and Hebrew are the parent languages of Aramaic. So yes, that would be the term. But to go back to Sylvia's question, the reality is for many of the obligations that he has to her that she's allowed to forgive something. And she's allowed to say, I want a husband who's going to go study and I'm going to support him. And there are communities where that's considered a value. You know, I have had the situation in which people have come to me and said, I want a shidduch, and I'm looking for a guy who will sit and learn, and I'm going to teach for a couple of years, or whatever it is. Like, that exists. Whether it's a good idea or not is a whole other question, but it absolutely exists in some communities. We talked about financial security. We talked about physical security. There's also the issue of respect, to which we have already alluded. And indeed, the Talmud states that the man is obligated to honor her. It also states that she has to honor him. And here we get to another contentious point, but again, it has to be stated. I'm not a fan of sugarcoating. So the text that we already read, I'm actually going to jump out of order a little bit. Go to 13 first. The text, because we already referred to this, about him being obligated to honor her. So the passage from the Talmud that's relevant to this says, one who loves his wife like his own person, and honors her more than his own person, and guides his sons and daughters on a righteous path, and marries them off soon after they are of age. For this, they quote a verse from Job, and you will know there is peace in your tent, you will visit your home, and not either sin or lack, depending on how you translate the last word in the sentence. The word is techeta, it's either sin or to be lacking. Either way, the point about marrying them off soon after they are of age is to prevent problems. The idea being that if you leave late adolescents to their own devices within society, you may end up with problems. So that's what they're advocating is early marriage. But the focus here for us is this is one of the sources for the idea that he has an obligation to honor her more than himself. Having said that, now let's go back to number 11. Listening to one's father always precedes listening to one's mother. This isn't necessarily good advice. This is the law. I might think this was because a father's honor is greater than a mother's honor. That would be my assumption reading this. But it's not true. Leviticus 19 says one must have awe for his mother and father, putting the mother first. In other words, the biblical text that you may be familiar with from the Aseret Hadibrot, the Ten Commandments, says honor your father and mother. So I might have said that means the father's honor is before the mother's honor. But no, because this text says you have to have awe for your mother and father. It puts the mother first. In which one? In the this one? Ish imo ve'aviv tirahu. So it says that they are equal. However, the sages said the father always precedes the mother in terms of listening to her, because the child and the mother must honor the father. Now you'll tell me, but didn't we just learn that the father has an obligation to honor the mother also? So source number 12 explains what's going on. Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz, author of the Yisrael commentary to the Mishnah, says the mother is also obligated to honor her husband because he supports her. This is considered to be a trade-off. He is responsible for her financial well-being, and in exchange, he should be treated with respect. That's the trade-off. As I said, I'm not necessarily saying this is a good idea in a marriage. I think that if you have a marriage in which the man needs to assert his right to be honored, you're already in a lot of trouble. But that's what this is about. So what we've seen in the course of looking at marriage is an outgrowth of what we talked about with love and dating, which is you want to create an environment which is durable. And so Jewish marriage introduces issues like the transaction, like the witnesses, there was one other element. It was the transaction, it was the witnesses, and it was the durability of it, which we're going to have to come back to when we talk about divorce now, but the goal is to create a focus on each other, ona, as well as staying in the home for the year, as well as the prohibition against being alone with inappropriate relationships, as well as the sharing the meals together, all of which are created to create a focus on each other, and you create a sound environment for growth with financial security, physical security, and respect.